Hi, Chris Bentley here. Thanks for downloading this episode of Here and Now Anytime. We have some great stories in the works, deep dives on the arts, the environment, childcare, and much more. To get those, plus the top news of the day, make sure you subscribe or follow us in the app of your choice. Just search for Here and Now Anytime. And if you're already subscribed, I'd love it if you told a friend about us. And thanks. Now here's the show.
If 3M knew about the dangers of this chemical many decades ago, as the plaintiffs allege, should it be responsible for then cleaning out that water, that contamination out of the water supply, or should it be the ratepayer's responsibility?
No matter who pays, everyone who drinks water has a stake in cleaning up PFAS. It's Wednesday, June 7th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the director of a new documentary about one of the 20th century's most original artists. Namjoon Paik grew up in Japan-occupied Korea and began his career in post-war Germany as an avant-garde musician. But he found his medium with the advent of television.
Most people don't know that Hitler made the radio with no dials. One day, I woke up late and decided that if I were going to do a show, I want to make it very radical and new. I wanted to carve out a different path.
The father of video art, a little bit later. But first, we've got two stories today about environmental health and threats to it, from drinking water to air quality. If you're in the Northeast, you probably don't need me to tell you that smoke from wildfires in Canada is bringing dangerous air pollution to people from Maine to Virginia. Smoke has also drifted over the Rockies and the Midwest in recent weeks. Now, cities including New York and D.C. are under air quality advisories. In New York, public schools canceled outdoor activities today. We wanted to get a better idea of what the health risks are, so we called up Dr. Neelu Tumala. She's an ear, nose, and throat physician and co-director of the Climate and Health Institute at George Washington University, and she spoke to Scott Tong.
You and I are down in the D.C. area. It has been hazy here early this morning. I saw the sun was red and muted. What are the most important ways this is impacting people's health?
Right. I've been getting so many messages from colleagues, from friends, from patients about what could be happening to their health and how to protect themselves. And so one of the biggest concerns with this code red, which is an unhealthy level of air pollution, what this means is that everyone may experience health impacts and should limit their outdoor activity. And so a lot of times when we think about unhealthy levels of air pollution, we're most concerned about babies and children, young adults, elderly individuals, pregnant women, and those with underlying heart and lung conditions. But with this level, with this code red, everyone may experience some concerns to their breathing. And so some of the impacts people may be having is just when they're outdoors, they could feel the impacts of air pollution on their eyes, so itchy eyes. But the bigger concern is how it impacts their breathing. So people may be experiencing some shortness of breath. Activities that they are normally able to do easily may require increased effort. They may feel out of breath quicker. And again, anyone with underlying heart and lung conditions, especially asthma, are at higher risk of having an asthma exacerbation or worsening asthma attack than they normally would have with this higher level of air pollution.
What do you suggest people do or not do to reduce this health impact?
So one of the things you had mentioned was that in New York, schools are limiting outdoor activities. So that's one of the main things that can be done today is limiting activities outdoor. When driving, try to keep the windows closed. You can also set up a portable air cleaner in your home or an air filter. And then one of the things, because we are encouraging everyone to stay indoors more today, is try to limit activities that are going to worsen your indoor air quality. So try to, you know, not fry foods on a gas stove, you know, avoid burning candles, definitely avoid smoking indoors, anything that might exacerbate the already concerning levels of air pollution.
The sad reality is there are people in some parts of the world who face this kind of air quality every day. What do we know about long-term health impacts if people are exposed to this for a long time?
Right. So specifically what we're talking about right now is the smoke from wildfires. And so we're talking about these tiny particles that are able to travel within the lungs, and they cause inflammation and oxidative stress within the lining of the lungs. And that's how they impact breathing and increase the strain on respiratory function. But some of these particles are small enough to also enter the bloodstream, and they can increase the risk of high blood pressure, heart attacks, and stroke. And so all of these have short-term effects, but also long-term effects. So when people are exposed, whether in the United States or elsewhere, to poor air quality for long periods of time, their risk of heart disease and strokes increases. They have an increased risk of reduced lung capacity over time just because of all the inflammation that happens in the lungs. This is especially a concern for babies and children. And so it's one of those things where there's immediate effects and then, you know, very significant long-term effects in terms of contributing to increased morbidity and mortality.
Given these particulates are so small, does it help to wear a mask outdoor?
It does. Wearing a National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health certified N95 mask is helpful in terms of diminishing the number of particles that you're breathing in. The only thing I ask is that if you have heart or lung disease, that you first confer with your physician to make sure that it's safe to wear a respirator mask like this.
Dr. Tumala, finally, just stepping back, we are seeing more wildfires in North America. What do we know about the role of climate change amplifying this? Is there a way to know empirically how much of a contributor climate change is?
Yeah, so climate change is contributing to hotter and drier conditions, which is intensifying wildfire seasons, and anything that we can do to mitigate heat trapping emissions to try to, you know, avoid these hotter and drier conditions and potentially avoid worsening wildfire seasons in the future is going to be helpful. And in fact, you know, some models have estimated that the amount of fine particulate matter from intensified wildfires are accounting for up to 25% of fine particulate matter in recent years across the United States, which shows just how much these intensified wildfire seasons, in part due to climate change, are contributing to worsening air quality that we're seeing in the United States.
Dr. Neelu Tumala is an ear, nose, and throat physician at the George Washington University. Doctor, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Air quality fluctuates. And when it's really bad, you can see and even taste it. But contaminated water can often go undetected for years, as it has with harmful PFAS, forever chemicals, in municipal water supplies. After the break, we'll hear how two lawsuits are trying to answer a weighty question. Once you know there's poison in the well, who's responsible for getting rid of it? Stick around.
Three chemical companies have agreed to a major settlement over what are called forever chemicals in drinking water. These chemicals also go by the acronym PFAS or PFAS. And there is a separate case against PFAS maker 3M. Back in 2016, officials in Stuart, Florida found firefighting foam made by the company contaminated its water supply with elevated levels of PFAS. Now, PFAS pose several health risks, and the EPA is trying to lower that amount in drinking water supplies around the country. Meeting those standards will cost local water systems billions of dollars. Let's bring in now reporter Zoya Tierstein from our editorial partner Grist for more. Zoya, hello.
Hi, Scott.
This is complicated stuff, but just help us with the big picture. In these cases, these big chemical companies are accused of making products, I gather, like firefighting foam that allegedly polluted drinking water. So is what we're talking about paying for cleaning up drinking water?
That's right. It's all about who has to pay for this contamination. So there are water supplies across the nation that are contaminated with, in this particular case, in this lawsuit that involves 3M that's coming up, aqueous film-forming foam, AFFF, which is a firefighting foam that has been used by fire departments for many decades. That was made by 3M, and that foam has PFAS in it. That's what makes it so effective at putting out fires. So that foam has migrated over time into local drinking water supplies, and that's where you have that contamination problem.
All right, let's talk about the settlement from late last week. Three companies that once upon a time were all part of DuPont, Chemours, Corteva, and DuPont, face lawsuits and they agreed to settle, pay almost $1.2 billion. What did these companies agree to do?
Yeah, those companies are agreeing to pay for some of the cost of remediating those PFAS out of local water supplies across the country. So getting rid of PFAS is actually a very complicated and expensive undertaking. It's not as easy as putting a water filter in or any of the other filters that water utilities commonly use to filter out chemicals or nitrogen or nutrients in water supplies. So you have to, in some cases, invest in very expensive resins and then burn them. So it's a very complicated process. And so that roughly $1.2 billion settlement will pay for some of that. However, the looming settlement that's coming up with 3M potentially is for much more money, nearly $10 billion or potentially even more. I mean, the cost of cleaning out these chemicals writ large across the entire nation's water supply could possibly be in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
And should we assume that these chemicals are likely in drinking water systems around the country?
Yes, unfortunately, PFAS are in water supplies, they're in products we use all the time, they're even in our blood. Almost every man, woman, and child in America has this chemical in their bloodstream. So it's a very serious issue, and the thing at the heart of these settlements, this trial that's coming up with 3M, is, you know, if 3M knew about the dangers of this chemical many decades ago, as the plaintiffs allege, should it be responsible for then cleaning out that water, that contamination out of the water supply, or should it be the ratepayer's responsibility?
Oh, and let me ask you more about this this 3M case. As you're saying, there are reports that the company may try to settle. If it indeed goes to trial, are the plaintiffs planning to present inside documents from 3M alleging that the company knew a long time before it went public that these were dangerous chemicals?
Oh, yes. So there is a huge trove of evidence that, you know, if this case doesn't go to trial, won't see the light of day. Although I have seen some of it for my reporting because I was working with the plaintiff's legal team for a while to get some of those documents. But basically, what they're alleging is just years and years of, you know, secrecy, of knowledge at 3M and the highest rankings up there that these chemicals were dangerous to human health, that they were pervasive in the environment. And the plaintiffs are alleging that 3M actively kept that information from the EPA so as to continue making money on its products. That case is something of a test case. It's called a bellwether trial case. So that case is going first in the long, long list of plaintiffs. I think there's more than 4,000 of them total that are seeking to, you know, pin the blame for this on 3M.
And what can you tell us from your own reporting you just talked about as far as what the folks inside 3M knew?
Yeah, well, you have, you know, meetings with Louis Lair, who was head of operations at 3M at the time. He requested a private meeting in his office. He sent a bunch of executives to go meet with outside experts. They met with those experts, and there are documents showing that the official meeting notes from those meetings had omitted all of the most damning language from those meetings, that those experts had said this chemical is similar to carcinogens. It's very scary. We're a little worried. And 3M decided not to publish that. They didn't bring that to the EPA. There's also testimony that's more current from a former head toxicologist at 3M linking 3M's products to PFAS contamination in samples around the world. And so that's all some of the details that are in that case that may or may not go to trial. I mean, that's really what's at stake here. 3M is is willing to make a pretty large settlement to avoid going to trial, it seems.
Yeah, I read, was it Bloomberg that reported that there's potentially a deal on the table for $10 billion, significantly more than these three DuPont companies?
That's right. Although I will say that there have been some estimates that say that if 3M did go to trial and saw the whole thing through, it might be on the line for something as long the lines of $110 billion. So
oh,
it's, you know, it's all relative.
Finally, just stepping back, how big a moment is this in the PFAS story? I reported some of these stories several years ago, but now is there a sense that this could be a moment of corporate accountability?
I think so. I mean, people have been working on this for a long time, and there have been lawsuits against these companies since 2005, but there have never been settlements or talk of settlements at this scale ever. So I think that this is something of a watershed moment for these chemical companies who have been producing these chemicals.
That's reporter Zoya Tierstein with our editorial partners at Grist. She's been talking about who pays to clean up PFAS chemical pollution. Zoya, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, a new documentary explores the wild and original work of Namjoon Paik, whose art broke boundaries and embraced the new media of video and television. After the break, Robin Young speaks with the director of Namjoon Paik, Moon is the Oldest TV. Don't touch that dial.
And now we want to take a few minutes to look at the life of the late Korean-American artist Namjoon Paik, who is widely credited with being the father of video art. He had PhDs in Renaissance music and philosophy, played classical piano. But in the late 1950s, he came to New York and joined new friends like composer John Cage and began smashing barriers, smashing pianos, in fact, and black and white TV sets. Namjoon Paik was excoriated by early art critics, but then came an iconic installation. He put a seated Buddha in front of a television, watching himself on the screen. Suddenly, Namjoon Paik was a star. He coined the phrase electronic superhighway. He predicted TV would replace radio and someday everyone would have their own channel. With the inventions of the handheld video camera in the 70s and then the internet, he was right, wasn't he? Amanda Kim's new documentary about Namjoon Paik's life is titled after one of his art installations. Moon is the Oldest TV, is now running on PBS. Amanda, you are Korean-American, but you're young. Did you always know about Namjoon?
My mom reminded me that in my home, there was this kind of stone box. My dad's cousin was an artist in downtown New York and knew Namjoon, was friends with him. And he liked to offer his friends little knickknacks, little doodles, gifts. And so he had offered it to her, and she had given it to my dad and my mom. More recently, I came across TV Buddha, and it really inspired me, and I wanted to learn more. So I started Googling him, and I get into these really intense internet research holes.
Yeah.
I thought he was extremely charismatic. I thought he was extremely intelligent and funny, and I was wondering why no one had ever made a doc about him before. So I decided to try and make it myself.
Well, thank goodness you did, and thank goodness you took us down those, you know, those rabbit holes, because it's astonishing, the impact. You know, long before The Who was smashing guitars, here's this guy, you know, smashing pianos. Here's a sound of that from one stage show. A foreign critic is narrating. And your film, it's like a giant collage of interviews, news clips, archival footage. There's Allen Ginsberg, cellist Charlotte Moorman. She would do these art installations with him where sometimes she'd be naked, or he'd put little helicopter propellers on her chest.
Hi.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wait. Oh, no, this is very serious. They're so big, Pike. I'm not an airplane.
Talk a little bit about some of this work and what it was meant to do.
One thing that was really exciting to me about Namjoon, but also a challenge in telling his story, is that Namjoon was really hard to define, and even his art practice spanned a lot of different mediums. He did sculptural work, performance artwork, and he collaborated with Charlotte Moorman and did these like amazing nude cello pieces. He was really interested in breaking the taboo of classical music and nudity. The kind of through line of all of Namjoon's work was that he was always trying to challenge the status quo and break the rules. So why do you have to play a violin the way you're taught with the bow and strings? You can drag it on the ground and it can make just as, you know, beautiful music.
So he seemed to be wanting to tear things apart till he got to the very essence of it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, destruction and creation are not that far apart. I think that was really a part of his ethos.
Yeah. As he's going along, though, he's certainly making waves in, you know, the artist's lofts in downtown Manhattan, but he's not making money. He's kind of like a Charlie Chaplin character, walking through the streets of Lower Manhattan with a violin that he's dragging by a rope, his head inside a television, you know, without its innards. There's something sad about him.
I don't see it as sad. I think it's empowering. It's a way, a lot of times his almost performative actions and the way in which he plays jester is a way to challenge your assumptions. He's almost disarming you with a sense of humor. I think that's really powerful in the way that he does that. For me, the performative actions of him dragging a violin or him sticking his head in a television are different from the money issues that he faces, particularly as he detaches himself from his family and he moves away from home. And the art that he wants to do is extremely expensive as well. And New York is such a hard place to be as an artist.
We'll talk about home, being Korea, and how much what was going on in Korea impacted him.
You know, Korea was one of the poorest countries not that long ago. So in 1950, when the Korean War broke out, you know, Nam June left home and most people didn't even know anything about the Korean War, particularly in the West, or anything about Korea. And I think that inspired a lot of his work to try and connect the world and spread Eastern culture in the West.
Yeah. As he starts to command some attention beyond the avant-garde art world, you have some wonderful historic, footage. He works with the famed director David Atwood at WGBH in Boston. This is 1968, wanting to use their televisions there and use the television studio for all of these effects that he's working on. And of course, now they're second nature to us. But at the time, as you describe it, some of the engineers there were just like, what's this guy doing with our TVs? Yeah.
I mean, basically what Paik did was alchemy. He moved the screen from being something that's plastic or concrete, and he liquefied it.
And then there's a show with WNET in New York. This is 1984's Good Morning, Mr. Orwell. Now, the first live global satellite broadcast was back in 1967. That had the Beatles and Marshall McLuhan. But Nam June wanted to bring a satellite broadcast further. He enlisted his home country, Korea, and others for what was the first live satellite art show?
Yeah, so it was the first kind of art installation on live television connecting many countries on New Year's Day.
It was insane. I mean, George Plimpton is the host. He gets drunk as the thing goes along. Various performers are stoned. You have Laurie Anderson. Is she singing with Peter Gabriel? Who's she singing?
Yeah. When I see the future, I close my eyes. I can see it
now. Although we had the best director, they all got out of their mind, really panic around 40. I mean, it's just panic, I just let it happen.
That's Nam June Paik saying later that the best part for him was the mayhem in the control room because things wonderfully fell apart. Amanda, you tell us critics thought it was a waste of time, but millions watched in places that had been isolated. And that's also his legacy. You remind us he'd watched his home country, Korea, torn in half. He wanted to use instruments of war like satellites to bring people together. He envisioned a future that binded us all together?
So one thing that I really admire about Nam June too is that, he was extremely prescient, but he was also always willing to evolve his ideas. So in the 70s, he wrote a proposal coining the term electronic superhighway, which later Al Gore used in the 90s. And Nam June then, a decade or so later, called his friend in the middle of the night and said, actually, I don't think it's a highway. We're in a boat in the ocean and we don't know where the shore is.
That's right.
And so he understood that the internet was going to be this murky place and finding the shore was going to be the key.
Yeah. What should we think of him? What should we know about him? I feel like you, that he should get more credit.
There's something about Nam June that really spoke to me. I wanted people of my generation to hear his message and see his work. I think that what he's talking about is so relevant to the world that we're living in now, where all of these communication technologies are coming out and we just take it for granted. We're just mindlessly using these things. And I think Nam June was always challenging and questioning these new technologies through his art, deconstructing and then reconstructing in new ways how we can use these things to serve humanity. And you look at his art, the Buddha watching itself in a closed circuit loop, and you think so much of what we're, you know, us constantly faced with our own image, obsessed with our image on our phones, social media. There's so many things that it makes you think of today. And I hope that Nam June can inspire us now.
Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin. It was a pleasure.
This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Gabrielle Healy, and Karen Miller-Medson. Today's editors were Gabe Bullard, Todd Munt, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.